Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast.
Thank you very much, Dr. Petrovich Staylor. It really was a succession of very heavy-hitting discussions and conferences, and I hope that I will be able to provide a continuation for this, which feels almost like a satire play after two tragedies. I also realize that I haven't actually introduced myself. I guess some of you were there in the first session as well. And I'm Derek de Kerckhove, and former director of the McLuhan Program in Culture and Technology, and very interested to continue the research that was begun by Marshall McLuhan in the relation between media and their audiences and their publics. And so you will find that there's a lot of influence coming through what I'm going to talk about. Right now, I still teach at the University of Toronto and also at the University of Naples in the Department of Sociology. I realize that I forgot to put the title of this talk. Oh, I know. We should do like this. Okay. And he'll come. Okay. So yes, I realize I forgot to. Is it coming? No. Oh, there we are. I forgot to put the title, but the title I was thinking about was the indiscreet charm of the cyborgeoisie, which we'll be able to come back to. I just wanted to address an issue which was raised at the very first talk that we had here by Dr. Kittler, Friedrich Kittler, who reminded us that in spite of all the extraordinary features of the innovations of Dr. Ishiguro and the character, his double, his geminoid that you can see in the Lentos Museum, something maybe was missing in the proposition, which was the relationship to language and to what extent was that character capable of dealing with language, saying that perhaps if there was anything to do with human nature would actually be based or would have something to do with language. That's something that hit a chord with me because indeed I feel that perhaps whether a fiction or not, human nature is in terms of how we deal with it, how we feel about it, whatever it is we do feel about it, very much grounded and very much rooted in our relationship to language. And so here you see a sort of a graph that is imprecise, but at least gives you proportions between the amount, the number of generations that were limited to carry language with their body, express language with their body, an oral culture without, you know, externalization or an external support for language, followed by 300 generations of people who had developed a writing system that allowed them, in fact, to accelerate considerably the development of culture in various directions. And then in adding to that the possibility of printing, further accelerating this relationship to language, and then flipping into what is now the very rapid fire of the new guise of language, which is electricity. And I say electricity rather than digital or electronic because fundamentally that's where it's at. We are now in the third phase of electricity. The first one was analog with heat and light and energy. The second one was the digital one. It still is, they're both around, of course, which is the transformation of electricity into information. And the third one is, of course, the wireless Wi-Fi environment in which we now live, which makes electricity transport an active processing of communication constantly. The important aspect of this graph is the relationship of language to the body and to the world. In the first 1700 generation that you see there, what you have is language controlling bodies. It's the word of the chief, it's the word of the priest, it's the word of the magician, it's the word of the storyteller. Language is in between people, it's always expressed, and hence controls people. The speaker is controlled by his audience, and the audience is controlled by the speaker. It's a mutual thing, but the language is outside and controls bodies. Very important, then, to recognize the reverse operation in those 300 generations of writing and of printing, where instead of having language external to the body, the language is internalized and also externalized for control, not anymore controlling you, but you controlling it as a reader and, of course, as a writer. This is where a new nature of the of a new human nature starts developing. In fact, this is also where nature itself is conceptualized. The Greeks come up with the idea of phusis. I mean, both words, human and nature, have to be critically examined, but clearly, phusis is an invention of the Greek. They needed a big container for their universal space in which we, people, will become little actors. That's it. So we have language-controlling bodies in an oral society, and we have body-controlling language and then turning it into thought in a literate society. The big question is then, what is the relationship to language that we are now having as it is being electrified? And I think that's where we're trying to go. I will skip that because we don't have all the time, and I want to have time for questions, but that's my basic theory about how the alphabet reoriented reading to the right, and writing from left to right as opposed from right to left, and that has consequences on things which I will show you right now, the left and right biases. I can ask anyone here which line goes up and which line goes down, and the answer depends on whether you read the thing on the left or whether you read the thing on the right. These are significant refinements in writing that condition spatial, temporal, and self interpretation. Hence, a very strong bias or biasing effect on human nature. For example, the conquest of the self. This is typical of the mechanical age and of the literate age. First, you separate text from context. You cannot do that in Arabic or in Hebrew, because you always need the context in order to interpret the text, because the text is not unique. You have to guess the vowel contents between the consonants in both cases. So the context is always dominates over the text. In Greco-Roman writing and arts, the text dominates over the context. Then you separate the reader from the text. In other words, you make the person independent from what it is that is written, and allow it then to manipulate. Separate the reader from the context, which I would say, and we will see consequences of this as well, the secularization of individual in Western Europe. And then you appropriate and privatize language, the appropriation of the writer-reader, and silence, this is most important, you silence language into thought. Suddenly language becomes totally controlled inside your head. You can say the word, you can pronounce the word that you read as you read a novel, but the fact you don't really need to do this, you basically have silenced thought, and you have silenced language, and you have turned it into thought. And this ends in privatizing a self, which separates itself from the objectivity of the world. That created a great deal of problems for the previous model of human behavior, which was supported by religious environments. And in that sense, I am very close to what I've heard from Dr. Schmidt Solomon. There is indeed a very biased kind of environment, or linguistic environment, in this oral society, dominantly oral society. When the private individual rises into this oral society, what happens is religious wars. This is the first of the great dramatic transitions from one vision of human nature, and the one that we'll be following by Da Vinci and others, creating the individual person. The other expression of this is the Spanish Inquisition, where in fact the whole issue is to question the silence or the interiority of the person. You go inside the head, and in fact the whole The whole battle for tolerance that goes all the way through Voltaire and various people has been in order to retrieve the total privacy of the mind. But the question of the Spanish Inquisition was to get it out of the mind, make it public again. But now we are into a situation which is totally different. We have reversed, perhaps, the relationship of the physis over the culture. God, the human genome code has been unraveled. Damn hackers, now I've got to change the password. All these moments are mystical moments. The time we finally decode the human genome is a mystical moment, not because it has not been preceded by decoding other genetic codes or by not having other things before. No, it's the kind of critical moment at which we can say that culture is taking over nature. It's the moment where the moment of great reversal. At which point, of course, there are all sorts of consequences that happen and that follow from this. I guess many of you are readers of Wired. I'll go through a few of these, but for benefit of time, not all of them. But I like this formula, expired tide word for concepts and things that people are talking about. This is just to see about the kind of reversals that are occurring now in our electronic environment. Expired is frontality, not really expired. We are still frontal, I'm still frontal to you. I still go to see plays and theater. We still do it. But fundamentally, the principle of frontality of all of us has now been reversed into being immersive. We are immersed in an information environment. We're literally swimming in it. Linearity and hypertextuality, I think I don't need to make a big case out of this for the moment. The important one will be explosion and implosions. It's the important one because that's the one that is critical in, I think it's one of the features that is critical today in the kind of implosive quality of the world falling upon itself. I will have occasion to get back to that. Mass media, long tail, we'll skip. Just note to you that the network, the world of broadcast was called network, and the network now has been stolen by the world of the internet. But indeed, the social networks have replaced the whole kind of broadcast attitude that we have known since the beginning of literacy. In fact, since the beginning of the oral societies. Real estate, Second Life, I call that the objective imaginary. We are now exporting all our strategies and cognitive skills, we are exporting them to screens and via screens to, of course, the internet and to a global communication. Locality, agility, materiality, the rest is relatively easy to figure. But what are the things that are worth looking at today in my line of search? I will want to explain what I mean by the post-Galilean moment. Galileo is the moment when the world goes from myth to solid, goes from fluid to solid, from myth to logic, from myth to scientific. It's the moment where things, it's again a mystical moment. It's preceded by a lot of other people and it's followed by a lot of other events. But the post-Galilean moment is, I mean more momentum than time here, is the time when we are moving back from the solid to the fluid. Just read any book by Zygmunt Bauman and you recognize that there is a documentation. You need to recognize this. Look at the wonderful maps that we were shown by Ethan Zuckerman yesterday. You realize that fluid and flow is actually one of the principles of the organization of society today. The era of the tag is the soul of the internet. It's the little address that is made, given to each one of the bits of information that contain your name, for example, or your photograph or Flickr, and actually has not only the precise address of that bit, but also its and the address where it's supposed to go, but also its number of reappearance, of reconstruction. The tag is the soul, and now the tags are everywhere. We are just tagging everything in various guises with different technologies. The point of being, I'll come back to, it is what is coinciding with your point of view. If the Renaissance has given us a stance to judge the world and see it as a spectacle in objective theories, the present electronic condition puts us at the center of things, but actually requires a sort of a sensibility thing. It has to be more than just a thought. We have to feel again, and we do. We are touching everything, and everything touches us via electricity. So the point of being takes that much more significant value. Returning the tactile dimension in our sensorial makeup. Orality is the condition of people carrying cell phone. It's a condition of being accessible in various guise for various types of communication. I talked about the objective and shared imaginary Second Life is a banality in terms of what it actually affects, although it did attract a lot of people, but in terms of what it means in the maturation of the simile game that the internet and the electronic era is playing with our cognitive strategies, it is the externalization of our internal imaginary. I'll skip my machine direct connect because it's a little bit complex to explain, but basically it's the relationship that we could have directly from our thinking to the screens or whatever medium we will be using for that. Hypertinence is that trend, that tendency of search engines to always improve the delivery of the responses that they have to the query, giving not only the text but also the context. Somehow, providing the text in the context of the query. There is a high pertinence also in the homeopathic communication. Homeopathic communication is any little dose, and yesterday we had many examples of that in the discussions around cloud computing. A small dose or a little bit of information sourcing somewhere on the internet finds not only its means of accelerating, but also its precise connection. Any message in the internet is a message in a bottle, but the whole ocean is reading that message. Hence, homeopathic communication is a principle of communication within the internet. But it's also a principle of high pertinence because it goes and gets the people it needs. Which is you may doubt some of this in terms of what your experience has been with Google or whatever, but it is in fact the sophistication of the relationship between the user and the system is getting incredibly more improved. Global art, I will not have time to come to it, but it is a concept that I'm trying to develop right now in order to find the art that reflects the globality of our being, our present way of being. But I had to skip that because we won't really have time for that, neither much for auto-organization of humanity. What I wanted to say is there is this, I read a lot about post-human and things, and I'm interested in this question of human and what does the human, if there is such thing as a human quality that is transcending our various guises and our various transformation throughout various support of language, how does it manifest itself? And I think, again, another myth that I find extremely attractive and for me very, very profound is that of Pinocchio. And I'm sure you all know the story of Pinocchio. He is a little character made of wood that appears about the same time as the Industrial Revolution is pushing its industries in the Valley of the Po, and of course not too far from Tuscany where Pinocchio was born. And why is Pinocchio arriving at that moment? Well, my interpretation of the myth is that he arrives there because myths do arrive at the confluence of various kind of influences, and it arise in the writing of Collodi as a little mechanical structure, an image of man, an image of nature, of human nature in some way, but it's not human. It's a mechanical one. And by the agon, the story of Pinocchio, society goes through transformation, goes through the actual desire to become human beyond the technology. Pinocchio wants to be a little boy. That's the essence of the story. How does he become a little boy? Well, he has to do a bunch of things little boys should do, and there's the old moral stuff, and if you lie, your nose grows. All that is immaterial. What really happens, he wants to be a boy, has to go through some sort of initiation, and then goes into the fish, the mother, the matrix, and then comes out, spit out, from the belly of the whale, obviously not gone to a real mother, as a little boy. Very interesting, because we have this one. We've done the same thing. We're doing the same thing with the series of The Matrix. I know The Matrix is not very current, but nevertheless, in terms of its mythical value, it has really grabbed a lot of people's attention. My sense is that The Matrix is indeed the same process as Pinocchio going through the digital matrix. Can we recover humanity beyond the technology? In other words, are we really post-human? I don't think so. Are we going to a post-human condition? No, I don't think so either. We are probably going to go a much more connected one, and I'll get back to this, but I don't believe much. I think post-humanism probably is a better term to employ than post-human, because I think just as Pinocchio's, we are like Pinocchio's right now. completely tied to our cell phone, completely tied to our keyboards. We're doing all kinds of things, you know, that are making us slaves to us. And in fact, I'll come back to that. But on the other hand, as we are going through and learning how to integrate and be integrated by that system in that new kind of environment, we may also recover humanity at the other end. This is the most attractive, the only attractive image I found which was associated with post-humanism, but we'll skip. Here's the title of my paper, The Indiscreet Charm of the Cy Bourgeoisie. The whole idea of these three artists, and I'm glad that we come back to art, as we did with Dr. Petrovich Seeger, fundamentally insisting on the dimension of art to explain things through us. But these three artists, of which one is my colleague at the University of Toronto, Steve Mann, all three are actually integrating the electronic system, nervous system, within their own and creating an interface with everything, becoming immediately global in that sense, but we're all global anyway with our cell phones, but actually giving a literal exploration and value to the connection of with the whole planet. On the other hand, the problem with the cyborg, and these are three people that, well, maybe Stellark and Steve Mann would be considered as cyborgs, the problem of the cyborg, not a problem, but the fact of the cyborg, the whole theory of the cyborg, from Donna Haraway's manifesto all the way to these experiments, tends to be a sort of inverse romanticism. The romantics were actually opting for nature. The cyborg is opting for technology. But you can see that there is the same kind of scope. It's a choice that people make of self-representation. I'm not sure that we have the human nature all concentrated in these particular actions, but it is interesting to consider that that is an option, an artistic, an aesthetic, and a genre also that gives us a kind of certain range, an echo to the classical romanticism. This is the attempt to express how our technologies are putting us at the absolute center of things. The sixth sense is something that's on the way that was presented at TED conference, the last TED conference, by Patty Mass, who you see there and her student. And what it is in fact a system that allows you to be in constant communication with the internet and with the environment, combining the virtual and the real, combining the informational and the material, by having access to information with whatever you see, whatever you touch, doing all kinds of things that allow you to, that put you literally in the middle of this immersive environment. I'll skip because you can go and see Patty Mass and The Sixth Sense on TED, and I suggest you do because it's a fantastic film which explains things very well. But to come here, the question is, when electricity is everywhere and when information actually, whether it's via television or the internet, is bringing the world in, actually reducing it, you have an implosive tendency that succeeds the explosive trends of the alphabetic culture. Where you have, I would say, the history of explosion from the explosion motor, the motor of explosion, which itself is a result of the tendency of scattering things, which the alphabet has, all the way to the atom bomb and the explosion in Nagasaki, is the actual story of explosion. That puts the end, Nagasaki and Hiroshima put the end to explosion as a principle of social organization of the planet, of end of colonialism, end of spreading the power and the conquest in various parts of the world, and brings it into the reverse order of implosion, which the present situation is one where terrorism is the form that is taken in an information environment. In an information environment, information is more powerful than the material deeds. So instead of killing millions of people in a bloody war, you basically attack a small group of people, but make sure everybody gets to hear about it. Again, following the description of Beyond Good and Evil by Dr. Schmidt-Solomon, clearly I'm not putting a value judgment to this. All I'm saying that it is the results of dynamics, of a physical dynamics of reversal, which is absolutely normal in this particular electronic era. The point of being is electricity's answer to the point of view imposed by literacy. I think I've said enough on that already. I can then go to this theme, the post-Galileo moment. I will end up on this thematic. The post-Galilean moment is really very well expressed by quantum physics. It is the indeterminacy and the total movement that is represented by our the stuff of our matter, what we know of the stuff of matter that we are made of, so that matter and information find at the other end a kind of a new bridge and a great fluidity. Transparency, I'll skip. Multiplication of identities, I think we sort of understand what this means in terms of how we multiply ourselves on the internet in various guises. Ubiquity, total surround, omnipresence, a quantum epistemology, I'll come back to that, and I think it is something that is not yet in place, but is probably the next thing after the logic epistemology and the software epistemology that we have created for ourselves. The next one will be a quantum epistemology, leading to the not World Wide Web, but the world we want. That's, in short, what I want to say rapidly here. I am interested in the momentum, and that is that there is a lot of dynamics, there is a lot of movement and power in this evolution of man right now, of mankind right now. The world as will and representation, which is Schopenhauer's expression of the power of the mind on reality. And, of course, this echo by Schrödinger, in quantum mechanics, things are not, they merely tend to be. And remember, I am trying to get to the where we are going today. What kind of people are we becoming, or can we become? The time of quantum is the time of emergence. Things emerge from self-organization, simultaneity. In fact, I would be interested in hearing Dr. Schmidt-Solomon talk about the relationship between quantum and this idea of the will. At which point do we have between the will and the freedom a kind of particle versus wave dichotomy? Simultaneity, ubiquity, and matter susceptible to observation. This is very, very close to one of the many brilliant statements by Giordano Bruno, of which Dr. Schmidt-Solomon is co-founder, the foundation of which Dr. Schmidt-Solomon is co-founder. Bruno has this whole philosophy that, in fact, we are summoning reality as we think it much more than it is imposed to us. But, of course, we don't know this, so we continue to be victim, and Dr. Schmidt-Solomon is one person trying to liberate us from that sort of problem. The aura and power of the electronic saint, a new responsibility because we are extended now globally. We're all global. I don't know how many of you do feel. In fact, it would be interesting to find out. How many of you have felt, feel, or could feel global? No one. That's very... Oh, see, there's one person. That's two. Good. Well, that's good. It's a beginning. It's a disappointing result, obviously. You're a very bad class, but I will take it for under advisement. But it is true that whether we feel global or not, the sense of responsibility that we have individually is challenged now by the environment and not anymore simply by our sense of guilt. We all do feel a little bit part of the environment to a certain extent. Hence, we have extended responsibility and sense of whatever we should do to a much larger realm than the one that we normally live with. And maybe that's what I mean by being or feeling global. We have a much greater power of the mind now than ever, and we will be getting a lot more power of the mind because of this formidable externalization of our intellectual and cognitive strategies out on screens and into the internet. Hence, with homeopathic thinking, the possibility of actually becoming the weak force in the physics, that is that which actually does affect change, human attitude, being that which may eventually win the game in the end when we are trying to survive the present transition, which, of course, is difficult, as we all know. Changing the world we want is actually the title of a book by one of my colleagues at the University of Toronto. Willing the kind of world, not being victim of history anymore, but wanting to actually do it, and do it in the way that we really want to live in. But we have to be careful. The problem is, electricity fundamentally is not democratic. Electricity is actually showing signs of being less and less democratic as we are going along. I was delighted by yesterday's discussion on cloud computing and the freedom and the hope and the enthusiasm that these young people were showing and how wonderful works they were doing, but this is a period of grace, perhaps, in the actual trends that I feel are beginning in our back, so to speak, and sometimes right in our face, that we find in China, for example, with the Great Firewall of China, and very effectively presented yesterday by one of the speakers, or in the present situation in Italy, where where the present government is in trying to implement a series of laws preventing bloggers to actually say what it is that they want to say and holding them up to fines, but not only the bloggers, but also the servers or the people, the information providers. Hence, muzzling, as you can see, the social body. This is an incredibly fragile position. Why? Because I come back to what I said at the beginning. In an oral society, language controls the body. In a literate society, the body controls language. You suddenly acquire an individuality, you have a person. What happens in an electronic environment? In an electronic environment, you are repossessed by the outside. You are repossessed by the electronic environment. Electricity doesn't want to actually leave you your freedom. Information may want to be free, as John Perry Barlow said famously 20 years ago. But in fact, the freedom that we have as individuals is very much threatened by the amount of information we leave. Small example, Facebook. How many things have you said on Facebook that you will regret the day your future employer is going to go there to see who you are? I mean, there are lots and lots of things that happen that are now held, you know, in that McLuhan said it very well. He said, the more they know about you, the less you exist. So it's a serious question. So we have to be very careful about that. And of course, we're not. Because we take it all for granted. It just flies over us. We get caught into it. We let it. How can you possibly let all your information go onto Facebook by becoming a private property of a single company, when in fact the internet is neutral enough for me? We have to be careful. I think we can will the world we want. We can get to the quantum psychology and the quantum epistemology, but we're not there yet. So I'm concluding in honor of Dr. Schmidt-Solomon with a wonderful thought by Giordano Bruno. It is not matter that generates thought. It is thought that generates matter. This is why I'm saying Giordano Bruno is the philosopher for the quantum era. Thank you.